April 25th, 1980, Ithaca, New York, Ronald Gatour.
Okay. Well, I was went to graduate school at the University of Michigan in 1950, and after 1 year of receiving my master's degree, I was tired of school, or perhaps in any case, I wanted to leave school for a while. So in the summer of 1951, I went and worked at Northrop Aircraft Company in Los Angeles. And while I was there, I was in the servo mechanisms department, and one of the things I was asked to read and to report on to this group was Wiener's book on the interpolation, extrapolation, and smoothing of stationary time series, which had just been declassified only a few years before, because during the war it had actually been a classified document. It was called the Yellow Peril. Many people said that more American engineering man hours were wasted trying to understand this book than anything else. But in any case, this was where I first had any contact with probability and first became interested in it. And then after 1 year, I went back to the University of Michigan and wanted, since that's where I had been, and was interested in studying probability. But there weren't really any probabilists there. Darling had just come. Of course, he was a statistician, but also a probabilist. But the senior probabilist was a man by the name of Copeland, Arthur Copeland. So at that time, though, I knew I was interested in probability. So I went, and in the summer of 1952, one of the few places I knew, I went to Berkeley to study with Loew, whose name I knew from some papers. But when I was there, Neyman, who of course was the head of the statistical laboratory and a very domineering or dominant person at any rate, see, I'd already had 2 years of graduate work, and so I'd had the basic courses like complex variables and real analysis and algebra. But he wanted me to take all of these courses over again at Berkeley. He said undoubtedly the courses were much better at Berkeley, which may have been true, I don't know. But I didn't feel that I wanted to spend another year or year and a half taking courses that I'd already taken before. So at the end of that summer, I was very discouraged by this, and so I, at that time, went back to the University of Michigan since it was so late and it was the only place I could get a teaching assistantship. So anyway, then I became formally a student of Copeland. Darling was on leave that year, or I might have become his student. But Copeland suggested some problem to me having to do with vision, but that didn't interest me very much, actually. So actually, I worked on my own completely, and my thesis was my own problem, and which wasn't a very good problem or anything, but in any case, I did do it completely on my own. And then I was extremely lucky for some reason in that after I got my PhD in 1954, I was able to go to Princeton for 2 years as a fine instructor. And there, of course, it was a very exciting time in probability at Princeton at that time. Feller had, since 51, had been doing his work on diffusions and semigroups. And Dan Ray was there, Henry McKean was there, Hale Trotter was there, and most important for me, at any rate, was Ito was there for the 2 years at that time. And I'll never forget the first time I met Ito. I really was at a party that Feller had. This was in the fall, just after things had started, and Feller was a very convivial, outgoing, friendly person, and in fact, in the entire 2 years I was at Princeton, he was the only faculty member whose house I was in. For example. But in any case, he had this party, and Ito was there and sort of standing to the side. He had just come from Japan. His English was not too good, and he had difficulty understanding. And so anyway, I started talking to him, and then he told me the story that several days before that, when he had first arrived in Princeton, of course, he went to Feller's office to meet Feller or to introduce himself, because Feller had had arranged his visit. And so he knocked on Feller's door and went in and introduced himself. And Feller said to him, "Well, I'm glad to see you, Ito, but where's your harem?" And Ito said he thought he knew what the word harem meant, but he could not understand what the context of this was in Feller saying this to him. And he said that he was so shocked that he just couldn't say another word. He just and so that he had to essentially excuse himself and leave the room. And it wasn't until several days later, when he met Feller again, that he could talk to him. And of course, then afterwards, he learned that naturally this was just Feller's way, a joke. I mean, he was always saying something outrageous in some sense. And so, but then, for my mathematical background. Of course, when I came to Princeton, although I had a PhD and I had reasonably good training in analysis, my probability was very weak because I hadn't had much opportunity at Michigan. Although, again, I can remember in 1953, Mrs. Moy, who died some 10 years or so ago. Anyway, she was a student at Michigan, but had a special, I think, fellowship for women. And she was interested in probability, and she'd gone to Illinois to study with Doob, and she came back to Michigan with the page proofs of parts of Doob's book, and we had studied this together. In fact, it was interesting at Michigan because also Spitzer was a student at Michigan, and so it's
at the same time.
At the same time, he was a little bit ahead of me, maybe a year or two, but and he really wrote his thesis with Feller also. Although I think he was formerly a student of Darling, and I was formerly a student of Copeland, as was Mrs. Moy. And so it's sort of interesting that although there really wasn't much probability at Michigan, there were several probabilists that did come through there at any rate. But anyway, it was at Princeton that I began to really learn some probability, and mainly from Ito. Although, of course, I attended Feller's lectures and I took notes, and I have some, I still have them, of course, and some of them are very very interesting. More than interesting, but it was mainly in discussions with Ito. I wasn't married at the time, and Ito was there without his family. I had a car. We became very good friends, and we used to go to dinner almost every night and discuss mathematics, it was a very good time from that way, and that's really when in some sense I began to learn modern probability or what have you. And as I say, it was a very exciting time in probability at that time with, for example, we at Princeton heard about the work of Dinkin and his school on generators, although I'm not sure.
This was probably later. I think it was 55.
Well, it was during the two years, 54, 56, I was there.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure exactly.
Yes, yes.
And of course, Doob's paper on Brownian motion and semi-martingales came out during that period, and. Although Hunt's paper didn't appear until 1957, I guess, but we, of course, were beginning to hear about this, and Trotter's work on local time, and Ito and McKean were working very much on their on the diffusions, representing diffusions in terms of Brownian motions by time changes and all that. And so at least, I mean, of course, at the time, I didn't understand I didn't understand a great majority of all this, but still, in retrospect, it was a very time of great ferment in probability. And then, if I can continue this, after my 2 years at Princeton, and I was looking for a job, and I had several offers, and for reasons really having nothing to do with mathematics, I decided to go to the offers I had to the University of Washington in Seattle. And one of the lucky coincidences that happens is that at that same time, Blumenthal came there in 1956. And he had just gotten his PhD. I had had my PhD 2 years and had been 2 years at Princeton. But he had just gotten his PhD under Hunt at Cornell. So from the beginning, we discussed mathematics naturally. We became very good friends. But it took us several years, but after several years, we began working together. And our first work that we did was on sample properties of stable processes. And although Blumenthal had written his thesis on the quasi-left continuity, strong Markov property, the regularity of paths, and was a student of Hunt's, for 2 years after the Hunt's papers appeared, we really didn't do anything with them. In 1959, I went and spent the year 59-60 in MIT as a postdoctoral that I had. And there I listened to McKean lecture and became more interested in looking at... up until that time, I looked at specific processes for the most part. But anyway, to make a long story short, when I got back in the summer of 50, in summer of 60, Blumenthal and I decided to make a real effort to read Hunt's papers, which we did over the next several years, and we were very lucky getting into this field early, and so we were able to do some work in it. And I can remember talking to André Mayer, many years later, and he was saying that in Paris, in about the same time, I guess maybe 1960 or something, that he, at the suggestion of Loew, was also beginning to read the Hunt's papers. And so anyway, this is how I got working in Markov processes, and I've been doing it for the most part ever since somehow. Well, I'm not absolutely sure of this, but I think that officially he was a student of Bochner. I think Chung was officially a student of Bochner, and I think also Carlin was, in fact, too.
Oh, okay.
and Ted Harris also.
Oh, and what place was it?
Princeton. Yes.
I see.
I can remember Feller... telling about Hunt, maybe in the late 40s. I'm not sure the time element exactly. But anyway, Feller always said that Hunt was the smartest person he ever met, in the sense that he could just absorb mathematics, that he learned it very, very rapidly and the essence of it. I mean, and as I said, I can remember Feller telling some stories about this. Maybe some other people should be telling this, since this it's all secondhand in a certain sense. But in any case, Hunt at one time, when he was first at Cornell, the story that I know, at any rate, was that he was going to be let go at one stage because he hadn't published very much, shortly thereafter, he published this paper about Lie groups and probabilities on Lie groups and the Brownian motion, the paper on Brownian motion, which he proved the strong Markov property in the context of processes with independent increments, at any rate. Which of course Doob had alluded to in one of his papers, but saying that it would be proved in another, that it was intuitive. How did he phrase it? This was in his 1954 paper on Brownian motion and semi-martingales. That it was intuitively clear, but and that he would give that he would prove it as a special case of a more general theorem in a later publication, which never appeared. But in any case, and then of course, Hunt's magnum opus appeared in 1957 and 58. And again, there's an interesting story in connection with that, that evidently at one time, Kotz, of course, who was at Cornell at the time, Kotz and Hunt were going to write some sort of joint work on potential theory and probability. Of course, Kotz had done, like in his very famous Berkeley Symposium paper in 1950, but that their point of views were clearly different, and that in any case that their joint work never came to fruition, and then Hunt went on with this particular thing. One thing maybe I should mention, and it's not really in this connection, but we were talking earlier about Bochner. And one book that he wrote actually that influenced me considerably, really before I got into Markov processes, was his little book in the California series called Harmonic Analysis and Probability Theory, which I've found really full of lots of ideas, number of which I used at one time or another. And also I found a very good phrase in that book that, of course, not being a mathematician like Bochner, I can never use it in print, but I often use it in my lectures at any rate. When he's stating a theorem or something, and he would state it, and then he'd say, and subject to secondary assumptions, which could then cover a multitude of things that had to be assumed that might have been left out before. That's right. I think at Rice. Yes.
Yes. Once he called me by phone. Oh. With respect to Cato. Oh. Uh-huh. It was one telephone conversation with him. He's probably quite old now.
Yeah, I think he must be close to 85 or something. Yeah, he was at Princeton when I was there. The 2 years I was there, I attended a course of his, which was very interesting. It was called, One complex variable, but from the point of view of several complex variables, something like that. Anyway, it was in some sense, it was fairly standard material, but he had a very approach that was quite different from anything that I'd seen before, at any rate.
I remember receiving a letter from you in Moscow. With a request, I published something without a proof, and it was delayed because I included the proof in the book, and it took several years.
Oh yes, that's a very interesting thing. I meant to mention that. I thought in this context would be very good. This is when Blumenthal and I, at that time, were working on the theorem, or trying to prove that two Markov processes having the same hitting probabilities could be time-changed into one another, perhaps under some conditions, of course. Of course, this was something Feller had always talked about, the roadmaps and the speed along the thing. The interest, and of course, one of the things that we realized very quickly is that we wanted to show that and using the hitting distributions to characterize an excessive function. We conjectured the theorem that's now known by your name, Dinkins' theorem, that if you have this inequality for the hitting distributions, then that together with some regularity gives you the fact that the function was excessive. Or well, we felt that was probably true. But we couldn't prove it at all. And then we saw, and this was one of the few, as I think I mentioned to you, in my youth, I did make an effort to learn enough Russian to at least be able to decipher theorems, even if I, and I think in one of the, probably the Doklady, I'm not sure, I saw an announcement of precisely this theorem that we were needed. And so that's when we wrote to you. But the thing that was very interesting, and maybe you can confirm this, whether it's true or not, we then wrote our paper eventually, and we sent it to Dube. And it turned out that simultaneously, almost, McKean, who had been working on the same problem, had solved it. He had under somewhat different conditions, but he assumed it was a diffusion, so the process was continuous. But he had the theorem was consisted of two parts: a local thing, and then somehow an extension to the whole space. And he had a better, a more general way of going to the whole space. In any case. And so then Dube suggested that we combine this as one paper, because after all it was essentially the same thing. And of course, Dube's one comment to us was that he would accept it. And of course, he thought it was a good paper and all that. But he said that the one condition is that you and Blumenthal write it, not McKean, the actual English. But in any case, then later on we met McKean. Of course, I'd known McKean from Princeton, so I mean, he was a friend of mine, but the next time I met him or something, or maybe it was even in our correspondence about putting the paper together, we'd mentioned that, because he also had this result, and evidently it turned out that he also had written to you in Moscow for the proof of this theorem, completely independent of us, and you sent it to him. To him also. So
yes, I mean that I simply send a carbon copy of the letter addressed to you.
Right. Yes. That was quite interesting.
So this proof of this theorem was first published in your paper.
That's right.
Then I included it.
But we attributed it to you, of course.
Of course. I was completely.
But since it was a key step in our argument, we felt that we should at least, and the proof hadn't appeared yet in print. Yeah.
But on the other hand, I spent all my time writing this book, so and it, probably this part even had been written, so just to publish small parts separately.
And also, I since then, whenever I teach Markov processes, whenever we have some students, I always include this theorem, and I always tell my students how I really think this is such an incredibly clever proof, because it's actually quite simple, the proof, when you see what to do. But as I tell them, I'm very impressed, because I tried very hard to prove this theorem and was not successful, and now when I see the proof, it impresses me very much.
Pedagogically, that's a good. This is a pedagogical trick very much.
Yeah.
Ask students to try to prove by themselves something before using the
proof. Right. Yeah, that makes it more appreciated. Yes.
And Ito was, of course, much older than you. I
mean,
if he's older than I.
Yes. So he was, when I went to Princeton in 1954, I believe he was 39 at the time. I was 25, so he was 14 years older. So he would probably be about 65 now, I guess, then, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
He has retired.
From Kyoto.
From Kyoto.
Yeah, but in Japan, they have to retire at 63 from these universities. So, but I understand he's now teaching in a private university in I think in Tokyo. So he has to commute to Tokyo from Japan from Kyoto. Maybe probably only once a week or something like that.
Yeah, he's doing something similar.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
But you've never been in Japan.
No,
missed the opportunity.
I missed my opportunity. Right. That's the way it goes, I guess.
And what about your relation to Carmel? You spent this only once, a very short time.
That's right. I had in that was actually in 1965. I guess I was. That was the year I was spending at Stanford, actually. And actually, Cornell made me an offer to come here. And since I'd never been here, I wanted to come and visit the place at least to see a little bit. And I came. And of course, I'd known Frank Spitzer for a long time, and Harry Keston, I'd not quite as long, but I'd known him. And Hunt was here at the time, although he was just getting ready to go back to Princeton that year. And but in any case, for a number of reasons, I guess at that time Blumenthal and I had already decided to write a book, and that was one reason why I didn't want to leave Washington at that time. And also, I had become, I think, somewhat of a West Coaster. But in any case, I finally, although it was a hard decision, I did decline the offer, and I went back to Seattle. Actually, I only was in Seattle 1 year after that. That would be 65, 66, but that's when Blumenthal and I wrote the major portion of the book, the first draft at any rate. And but then in September, we worked all through the summer of 66 very hard finishing the first draft, and then in September of 66 I went to San Diego, and actually Blumenthal went to Germany for that year, 66 67, so we finished the book then by correspondence in a certain sense between San Diego and Germany.
I admire people who are able to do such things to work together.
Yeah. Well, of course, I say we had a very a good, more than a first draft. I mean, it was more a matter of just of polishing it and things like that.